call the Venice First Division to come to order. And we do stand for the pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have a quorum, and Representative Fisher approves the minutes. Minutes for March 23rd, 2015. Last time this committee
had met. Remember them well.
And all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are passed. Okay, I'd like to just welcome everybody. I know everybody's busy during the summer season here, and people ask me, you know, have I been sitting on a beach? No, I've been doing yard work in the yard. That's where I get the sun, but and a parade here and there. But I'd like to just thank everybody for coming. This is an informational hearing only. We want to hear from the TAG. General Nash is going to be speaking. Other people from his staff will be speaking, and they'll be available for also for questions from the committee. First of all, before we get into that, maybe on a lighter note, if each person on the committee could maybe share one highlight of their summer so far, and I'll start that. The 4th of July. I was marching down Main Street, Forest Lake. It's a huge parade, and all of a sudden I hear somebody hollering off to my right, and here my son, who's mentoring cadets at West Point, who's a West Point graduate, was en route to. They're moving from West Point to Fort Hood, Texas, and they came through Minnesota. And all of a sudden, I see him sitting in the crowd with his family and my daughter and her family. So that was a highlight for me to have grandkids here. And our other son came in also, flew in from Fort Meade, Maryland, and spent 5 days with us also. So that was my highlight. So let's just go around the corner here, and Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Family again. Grandson from. They live out in Spearfish now, and but came home for a week at the lake. We live on a lake in northern Minnesota, and as a seven-year-old, he got his first water skiing, and I guess that was sort of a highlight for me, and just time spent with the family, and 4th of July, all the activities that go around celebrating the birth of a nation and family, and makes for a good start to a summer.
Well, thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About 3 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, I took 3 grandkids fishing, 2 grandsons and a granddaughter, and I worried for the first 20 minutes about getting a hook in somebody's ear, and it didn't happen, and we took fish home and we ate, and the wife was worried about the kids weren't going to eat the fish, and the wife and I ended up having to fight for our piece of fish, so that was kind of fun. The kids ate good.
That was a puke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I have really enjoyed being at home, spending time with my husband, and this is the first summer in a number of years anyway that I've planted all my flower boxes, all my flower beds, and they're looking fabulous, and it's just great. Look forward to connecting with both of our kids later this summer. They both live out of state, so looking forward to spending that quality time then.
Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Family again. I've got my youngest grandson up there and my wife, and it's an opportunity for my youngest grandson to see what we do here in Minnesota. He currently lives in Washington, D.C. area, and as a matter of note, his dad's hard at work back there. His dad is a retired Army Reserve officer, so we've been out checking calves and putting up hay. Right. So, great highlight from my summer.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Clearly, this interim meeting is the highlight of my summer. Nope, getting a lot of projects that have been on the to-do list for a couple of years done around the house, and it's almost to the point where either you sell it and buy something else, or you're going to stick there for a while. And so did the kinds of fix-up things, and it looks pretty good, so I think we're going to stick around for a while.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The highlight of my summer is yet to come. It'll be in the middle of August when my middle daughter comes home from her internship for a week or so. So we're looking forward to a good time at that point with all the family.
Well, that's our committee members. I would like to, just again, we'll bring up General Nash and his staff. First of all, we got Representative Heinzman. That's going to be speaking. Representative Heinzman, would you come up? Welcome, Representative Heinzman. Could you introduce yourself for the record here?
Sure. I'm Representative Josh Heinzman. My district is 10A. That's a Crow Wing County area. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Mr. Chair, thank you for the invitation. Thank you, members, for the opportunity.
Okay. Would you? I think you're here to talk about a piece of legislation that you and Senator Gazelka have put together. It's kind of go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This last Monday, Senator Gazelka and I had a press conference where we discussed a bill, and I was hoping for an opportunity. I'm glad to be able to talk about it for a few moments briefly today. It's somewhat in response to a number of constituents who had approached myself and, of course, Senator Gazelka as well, issues of concern over their loved ones' well-being while potentially being in a recruiting office or center. And so it should be, I think, both Senator Gazelka consider it a starting point to a conversation. And it's not a new concept. I was just visiting with Representative Corners. This is something that has been discussed through the years. But maybe it's time to discuss it again. And maybe over the course of time, it could be something that becomes part of a bigger conversation, maybe even becomes law. So essentially what our bill that we introduced would do would allow active duty military to have a concealed carry firearm in their possession without going through the existing statutorial requirements here in Minnesota for a concealed carry permit. So it would be very similar to what we have done. In fact, if you see a copy of the bill is in your packet, there's very little language that changes. It simply extends those privileges that are allowed for our police and other folks in law enforcement to conceal carry, and it would extend that privilege to law enforcement. So if there's questions, I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Good questions? I know I briefly looked through the bill, Representative Heinzman, I've had some people contact me, and I tend to agree that the training that we get in the military is a lot different than the train, being my experience in the military, when we, every once or twice a year, when we have to qualify. And the training that you go through, basic training, it's not the same as what civilians, when they get conceal and carry permits. That would be my concern there, is that that our men and women that are serving in the military also would need to have that training too. And that's where I would stand on it. I think what you do on the battlefield versus on Main Street, Forest Lake, at a recruiting center or whatever, we have civilian laws that we have to abide by. So If this bill does go forward, I'll probably have an amendment that the military would also that training could be done right within the National Guard during drill weekends or their annual training. So that training could be done right in the National Guard. I'm not sure if that's that we can do that, but I would rather see that done within the National Guard so that they have the concealed carry training. And so that would be my comment regarding that. Yeah, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My past experience in the military had to deal with a lot of Guard Force work, and I'm also a holder of a concealed or a permit to carry here with the state of Minnesota. And my comment would be that yes, absolutely, the training that's necessary there would easily be done as a graduate of our permit to carry program in Minnesota. Basically, it's a few hours and 10 rounds on range. Nothing like those folks that are involved in the military deal with. Yeah, first druthers would be to leave the training within the armed forces, you know, meshed up with the requirements on the private side. But I do, as one who lived in overseas in times where we got the ship underway when we had a problem, but guess what? Our dependents stayed ashore when we got into a security situation that was particularly unique when we had the Red Brigade issues over in Europe. So I appreciate we sit in a private, commercial, wonderful, almost 100% safe environment. Unfortunately, those that wear the uniform, whether they be in the armed forces or the police officer, fireman world, stand out. And we do know that clearly some of those folks have been selected as targets. So my interest is to make sure that we provide that most opportunity to be able to defend themselves. But I share your I guess interest in making sure that we go forward with something like this, that there's ways to do that, I think, within the armed services. But my guess is it would be even a more aggressive qualification training program than we see on the private side. I recognize Representative Heintzman's and Senator Gazelka are certainly bringing forward something we absolutely have to look at, because we do live in an environment that is different than most of us that are retired and served lived in over the past few decades. It's a unique situation. But I want to thank Representative Heintzman for bringing this forward, and they say he's spot on. It's a starting point here to see where we need to go with this.
Yeah, you know, we're just talking about a draft here, and I think Representative Heintzman wanted to get some feedback from the committee. And any other comments for Representative Heintzman? Any other comments? Well, thank you for bringing it forward.
Appreciate it.
General Nash. Well, first of all, General Nash and Mr. Kerr, just who gets the good seat there? Okay. Thank you for coming in, and I know that I think we can get a better seat for Mr. Kerr.
We're all right. This is good.
He wants to maintain a low profile anyway.
Low profile. Under the radar? Is that called under the radar?
Could be.
General Nash, thank you again. First of all, thank you for coming in, and obviously thank you for your service and being our Adjutant General of Minnesota, and for the work you do. I know I only hear about positive things from different men and women that are serving about your leadership, and that's why I felt it was really important to have you come in and talk about what we're doing in Minnesota for the force protection of our National Guard facilities that we have around the state. I believe we have about 65 facilities around the state. 60 of those are in our Army centers, and then there's a few, six or so, that are in the strip malls around the state. So I just want to, again, we'll let you decide if you want to just carry on with your discussion and wait for questions, or how would you like to?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could address the chair and the committee members that are here this afternoon, I would like to do that, and then take any and all questions at the conclusion.
Okay, we'll do that. Okay, so please introduce yourself for the record here. So,
I'm Major General Rick Nash, the Adjutant General for the State of Minnesota. And so good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm joined today by Mr. Don Kerr, the Executive Director for the Department of Military Affairs, who has presented to the committee in the past. Also behind me is Colonel Matt Vatter, the Director of Plans and Policies for the Minnesota National Guard. And finally, Major Lindsey Olson, my staff judge advocate and general counsel for the Minnesota National Guard. But, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to thank those of you on the committee that have served, and I know there's a committee member that is still serving, but also to the members of your family that have served not only our state, but our nation. And again, thanks for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, for inviting us from the Department of Military Affairs, because it appears in the last week or so we've been the center of discussions, both in the media and certainly by our senators and representatives. But to be able to come today to testify in front of the committee regarding the safety and the defense of Minnesota National Guard's facilities, our service members, and our employees. As you're well aware, for several weeks now, this has been a topic that has generated a considerable amount of staff analysis inside our own internal organization. And the tragic events that occurred in Chattanooga, Tennessee, earlier this month has brought this to a national attention along with this topic. And certainly this matter is unprecedented, and we do not have a reference point for an act in the history of our modern National Guard. And that's why we're here today and why the national and state discussion is going on. So on behalf of the more than 13,000 men and women of your Minnesota National Guard, I wish to express our deepest condolences to the families of our fellow service members lost in those terrible shootings in Chattanooga. The loss of a family member is always a tragedy, but the loss of young members of the military who are not deployed in harm's way is particularly difficult for families to bear. It's also difficult for our society to understand how to respond across the nation, where there are more than 3,600 National Guard facilities. And this is clearly an important issue, and we have devoted significant resources internally to minimizing the risk to our service members and their families from terroristic violence. So let me begin first by thanking those of you in the legislature for your concern for the well-being and the safety of our citizen soldiers and airmen. In the military, we call this broad topic of safety and well-being force protection. The topic of workplace violence is an essential consideration for a leader of any organization operating statewide. But as it relates to the military, it's force protection. But that is not, you may be surprising, the greatest concern that I have as your adjutant general. I'm more concerned about the negative consequences to our force from other sources and challenges that are endemic to our society and must be solved by all of us working together going forward. Some of these items include the impact of untreated chemical dependency, the repercussions of alcohol and drug-related incidents and accidents, the negative consequences of untreated post-traumatic stress and mental health issues, the scourge of sexual assaults in our force, and the impact of cybercrime on the readiness of our force. I will note that 24.5 million service members and federal employees had recently had their personal identifiable information, including their social security numbers, home addresses, and addresses of their family members, compromised through the data breach at the Federal Office of Personnel Management. And most disturbingly, though, the fact that suicide still claims the lives of more than 20 veterans and service members daily. These are my high-priority force protection topics, all of which are more likely to impact our Minnesota National Guard than a terrorist attack. I hope that you will not lose sight of that when you go back into session in March to address these issues that affect all of us serving our state and our nation, and to actively work to address our concerns. You invited me here this afternoon to discuss the Minnesota National Guard's action on safety and security of our members, and my recommendations on arming our force. I would like to do so by addressing the physical security of our facilities, our existing capability to defend our workplace, the Guard's exceptional relationship with law enforcement, and my recommendation for arming of the force. I will conclude with my thoughts on waiving the state requirements for a permit to carry on the basis of one's military membership. First, regarding the physical security of our facilities across the state. By way of background, Mr. Chair, you're correct. The Minnesota National Guard operates 65 facilities in 61 communities statewide. There are also additional what we call storefront recruiting offices located in strip malls in towns where we do not have a National Guard armory. Even before the shootings at a recruiting center and a Marine Navy Reserve facility in Chattanooga, the Minnesota Guard was taking steps to prepare for the possibility of an attack on its facilities. Though we continuously monitor and assess our security posture, we are directed by the United States Northern Command in May to fully review our force protection measures at each of our facilities and to implement certain additional force protection measures statewide. While we do not disclose specific security measures at our facilities, enhanced steps include, though, heightened physical security, verification of visitors, increased patrols, both our own and local law enforcement agencies, a review of emergency action procedures, and vehicle security measures. Security measures for state, National Guard, and federal facilities have been and will continue to be evaluated and enhanced as deemed necessary. On that topic, it's important to understand, however, that enhancing some aspects of our security posture carries significant costs. For an example, the cost to enclose our training facility at Camp Ripley is estimated at $8.4 million for the investment in the fencing. To make such a measure effective, we would require significant ongoing personnel and operating costs for added patrolling necessary to ensure the integrity of the fence as a barrier. My second topic concerns our existing capability to defend our workforce. Armed security officers are permanently stationed at the air bases in Duluth and Minneapolis. Camp Ripley, our largest location, has an unarmed security force with permanently stationed armed State Patrol and Department of Defense or Department of Natural Resource officers on the base. And across the state, the Minnesota Army and Air National Guard have and will continue to participate in active shooter response exercises in conjunction with law enforcement agencies at our locations. This has been and will continue to be one of our key force protection measures. Which brings me to my third point. The Minnesota National Guard has an exceptional relationship with law enforcement, and I want to emphasize that while our soldiers and airmen are here in the United States, the responsibility to maintain law and order and protect our citizens, including our military members, rests with local civilian law enforcement officials. We work very closely with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies around our state and have the utmost confidence in their commitment and ability to protect our citizens. We have no intention to usurp their role in enforcing the laws of this state and in protecting our service members and the other citizens of Minnesota. Civilian law enforcement agencies must continue to lead in this area because military forces are prevented by federal law from collecting and analyzing intelligence on U.S. persons. Law enforcement agencies in Minnesota have been very effective at identifying and addressing threats to our force. They have prevented serious incidents from occurring. To focus on arming the force detracts and dismisses what civilian law enforcement agencies are doing very effectively. And at this time, our force protection measures will not include arming soldiers and airmen whose regular duties are not security related. Circumstances could and will change, and the governor and I may determine it to be prudent to arm our force with military weapons or authorize our service members or employees to carry personal weapons in accordance with the laws of the state. In the event that that occurs, our analysis indicates that the necessary authority exists in current law and regulation, both at the state and at the federal level. If you're looking for my recommendation, there is no need for additional legislation on arming our force. I have provided a preliminary briefing to Governor Dayton and have continued to coordinate our efforts with his office. We have also engaged with the Office of the Commissioner of Public Safety and continue to work closely with them regarding this issue, as well as the FBI in Minnesota. In the event that law enforcement officials identify a credible threat, we have in place the decision-making tools to rapidly adjust our military force protection and collaborate with local law enforcement officials in response to those threats. These measures may include a decision to arm our service members at specific locations. I also understand, though, that we feel that we have a good situational awareness regarding threats to our personnel and our facilities. Any location is vulnerable, though, to a lone wolf, and we've seen that across the nation. Look no further than the horrific movie theater shooting in Louisiana within the last week for proof of that statement. I know that many members of the legislature and the general public have very strong opinions regarding arming our service members or allowing our employees to carry weapons while at work, both for and against. My own experience deployed to overseas theaters where weapons were routinely carried informs me that taking such a decision will have unintended consequences, such as unintentional weapons discharge. There may be injuries or property damage that could result in questions of tort liability. There may be weapons or ammunitions misplaced or stolen, causing a hazard to innocent bystanders and our own citizens. I also understand that once such a decision is taken, not in response to a specific credible threat, but as a general preemptive measure, it will be very difficult to logically wind it back. Physically protecting our service members in the armories and at the bases is a modest part of force protection. The vast majority of our 13,500 member force are traditional citizen soldier guard members, typically serving from 39 to 50 days a year in uniform. The rest of the time, these citizen soldiers and airmen are citizens primarily, and my authority to direct their activities and protect them in our communities is either restricted or non-existent, depending upon their place of employment. Due to the loss of their private information I mentioned earlier through recent cyber breaches, it is safe to assume that these off-duty service members would also be at risk. My staff is analyzing the legal issues and procedural items in order to determine courses of action that we can unilaterally enact that will increase security for our service members. And as it relates to my military staff, some of them here with me today, the Minnesota National Guard has experienced military planners, operators, and leaders who have experience analyzing threats and designing successful force protection measures in diverse sets of conditions. We have planned and executed everything from full-spectrum operations in Iraq and Afghanistan to domestic operations such as support to local law enforcement for the Republican National Convention, the World Trade Organization Convention, and border security in the Southwest. Part of our strength is in our deliberate planning methods that use principles of escalation of force. We work with law enforcement, state and federal, to ensure we receive the best intelligence for analysis. We plan for all contingencies, but respond with the levels of security and force that are proportional. Authorizing soldiers and airmen to be armed is a complex issue that requires rigorous legal analysis. The duty status of an individual, such as active duty Title 10, active duty Title 32, federal technician, drill status guard member, or civilian employee. The location of the facility, whether it's a federally owned or state owned, and the myriad of existing laws and regulations from the Department of Defense, their directives, military regulations, state and local laws, all bear on this issue we're discussing today. When the tragedy in Chattanooga occurred, I advised the Commander-in-Chief to be cautious and deliberate in making a decision to arm the military, as there are many other aspects that must be considered in that decision-making process. And there are many more questions and items to consider than there are answers. For example, arming the force without a specific, credible threat creates the conditions that will result in discovering unanticipated liabilities. Who will be liable for damages resulting from death, property damage, or injuries? What verbiage is the right language to ensure that the unintended consequences of a mistake with an issued military weapon are properly attributed? Our citizen soldiers and airmen need to be protected from liability when operating within their authority. But what happens when they exceed that authority? How can I ensure that they will be held accountable for negligent actions to protect the citizens of Minnesota? What language should be used? The phrase is authorized to carry, shall carry, may carry, will carry, must carry, allowed to carry, can carry, or approved to carry all have specific meanings, and we need to use the right legal term to have the desired effect. We have a limited number of handguns in the Minnesota Army National Guard and in the Air National Guard. Most of our soldiers are assigned rifles or carbines. How will we bear the cost of training, certifying, and maintaining qualifications for another additional duty when enough hours to train for our overseas federal mission don't exist? Added responsibilities will require additional time. Throughout the process, how will the work they were supposed to be doing get done? Arming our force will place additional psychological stress on our force, reinforcing, but perhaps unnecessarily, that they are targets, that protecting them is beyond our capacity, and that they must be responsible to protect themselves in our workplaces. Arming our force could restrict their access to places they need to go to do their jobs. Recruiters will be unable, under current law, federal law, to conduct business at the Federal Military Entrance Processing Station at MEPS for our young recruits, and they will be unable to conduct school visits when armed, to list only a couple of the prohibitive locations currently existing. And at what point will escalated force protection measures cause us to simply close our armories to non-military use? If we are successful in hardening ourselves as targets, the extent that potential adversaries simply choose to attack elsewhere. So you must ask yourself, what are the next soft targets? Would escalated force protection include state funding for reinforced fencing around Camp Ripley? Finally, when deployed overseas, our force operates under a very robust chain of command, with non-commissioned and commissioned officers supervising at all levels, working and living with our service members. Supervision is the key to ensuring safe handling of weapons and also critical to maintaining good order and discipline. Those close and constant supervisory relationships do not exist to that same extent in our homeland, and this increases the risk of an incident or indiscipline. Unlike the active component military, the Minnesota National Guard is a community-based organization. So it's essential that we maintain this connection and continue to be a resource for applicants who wish to consider a career in the military. Most of our facilities are public buildings under Minnesota law, and we do not believe that arbitrarily locking out the general public and adopting a bunker mentality serves the interests of the people of Minnesota. In addition to our armories throughout the state, Camp Ripley is an important resource for all people of Minnesota. It would be a shame to limit the opportunities for other state and local governments to use it, and to restrict the citizens of Minnesota from using the Camp Ripley Museum and other facilities currently open to the public that students and college interns habitually use during the summer, or to cancel our possible participation in the planned Camp Ripley recreational trail due to excessive concerns over security threats that are not confirmed to exist. We live and work in a free society, and we have to balance completing our mission throughout Minnesota with the necessity of protecting our service members. It's important that we do not overreact. We are also aware that the Secretary of Defense has tasked the Chiefs of Staff of the Army and the Air Force, the Chief of the Naval Operations, and the Commandant of the Marine Corps to study and recommend changes to current federal policies in this exact area. And I expect that the Secretary of Defense will make any changes to the current policy soon. We will analyze the results of that study and implement measures that are directed by the federal government where appropriate. Our national military leaders are taking the same prudent, thoughtful, non-reactionary approach before making a decision on this very serious matter as we are in Minnesota, as are the majority of states across the nation. In conclusion, it appears that this issue will expand beyond the complex question of my responsibility to protect our force in the workplace to a broader conversation about allowing service members to carry weapons off duty. So I will address some thoughts with you about that. First, I want to be clear that I support the rights of Americans to protect themselves in accordance with the laws of our state and our nation. Under those laws, I have responsibility to provide a safe workplace also for all of my employees. I also believe that we can provide for the safety of our employees under the current circumstances without abdicating that responsibility by asking them to defend themselves. I also know that a number of our service members will not be eligible to obtain a permit to carry, though they may continue to serve in the military. These service members may be suffering from mild mental illness, post-traumatic stress, depression, or have recently reported suicidal ideations and being monitored by our chain of command while they seek treatment to resolve their illness or to treat their injury. It would be completely irresponsible to propose that these individuals should arm themselves for protection in the workplace unless there were a very specific, very credible threat. For this reason, and two others that I'll highlight for you, I do not support waiving the state requirements for a permit to carry simply on the basis of one's membership in the military. The second reason I do not support such actions relates to the training required as part of the process to receive a permit to carry in Minnesota. The training that is required as part of the qualification is critically important to protect service members from the potential liability that they could incur if they choose to carry a weapon to defend themselves. It would do our men and women in uniform a disservice to provide a path to a permit that did not include this critical mandatory instruction that they do not receive as part of their military training. Additionally, it's important to note that our soldiers and airmen are trained to use their assigned weapons under combat conditions. Generally, they are armed with carbines, again, rifles, and light machine guns. It is unwise to assume that service members who are proficient with their assigned military weapon are automatically safe and effective if armed with a handgun. The third reason I do not support waiving the requirements is due to the infrequent nature of background checks performed once members have joined the military. Though the vast majority of our service members are honorable and upstanding members of our community, I cannot guarantee that all members of the military are fit to carry a weapon under Minnesota law. A background check and specific training are required for citizens of Minnesota under current state law, and our service members should be expected to meet the same requirements as other citizens in this case. Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, thank you for your attention and commitment to this topic of force protection in the Minnesota National Guard. I will look forward to working with you on not only the issue at hand today, but the broader societal issues that I mentioned earlier that concern our Minnesota National Guard in the upcoming session. So at this time, we will be happy to answer any questions you may have, though we will not discuss specific security measures at specific facilities in this open hearing format. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, General Nash, and I also agree with you about sharing things that are going on and security measures and so forth. This is an open hearing, and those types of things need to be kept within the National Guard. Those are my thoughts on that. Questions from the committee? Questions from the committee? Yes, O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Adjutant General Nash, thank you for being here with us on this beautiful summer afternoon where we could have probably been in many other places than in front of this committee. My belief for the reason for this committee hearing to be being called is not to question what you're doing for the Guard right now or how you're administering this as the Chief Executive Officer, if you will, of the Minnesota National Guard below the Governor as Commander-in-Chief. I think what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're providing you with the resources necessary, that if they don't exist at this time, that we're keeping people safe, whether they be civilians who are coming into a facility or whether they are sworn members of the National Guard. And through your testimony today, and I apologize, I did have to step off for part of it, but I couldn't help but think about the same kind of a situation that would happen with a sworn Minnesota law enforcement officer who would be on school grounds as a liaison officer, a DARE officer, or a school resource officer. They are a target in those facilities. Everyone knows who they are, whether they're in civilian clothes, but they're still discharging their sworn duties. And I know that when we in the community that I come from first started talking about putting their those officers in our schools, there was some real concern about should they or should they not be allowed to carry their weapons for their self-defense and or the protection of others that are in their charge. And I guess what I would ask you to help me to understand, we've restricted access to schools to try to make them safer. We've also put other checkpoints in and things. What could we do as a state to help you to ensure that our members of the National Guard and the public that comes in contact on state facilities or on recruiting facilities because to keep them safer? You threw out a pretty big broad net that we can't protect somebody in their own home who might have been identified as a member of the Guard. We can't do that really for sworn officers when they're on their personal time as well. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts or comments down that line, if you would, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
General Nash.
Representative O'Driscoll, that's a great question because those are, as I mentioned, I alluded to it, with federal installations with which obviously the state legislature does not have any control over policy at the MEPS building or federal installations that happen to be within the state of Minnesota. And it applies to our two air bases, or which are federal installations. And so they're prohibitive under current federal law, and that's what the Secretary of Defense is struggling with now. An active duty post like Fort Hood, Fort Bliss, pick a federal post, they're prohibited from carrying other than a assigned weapon if you're in the security aspect of that. But it goes to the point where we have our recruiting force that visits counselors in schools, as you mentioned, Representative O'Driscoll, that's an aspect I think that obviously is a local issue. You know, it's a school board issue, and I'm not sure I would leave that up to the legislature for your wisdom in terms of how you would address that. You know, it's a balance between the issue of protecting a quote-unquote target, someone in uniform, traveling around, doing their day-to-day job, visiting schools, providing career opportunities for our young men and women. Is the individual a target? You know, and there's arguments on both sides. We can still do our job without, as we currently are, unless a risk is of such a level, we could continue to do our job in an unarmed basis to still have access if that's prohibitive. I would have to think through all the other issues that we may have or may not have by forcing school districts to allow a armed member of a service to enter their schools. The other thing that comes in play, I need to make you aware of, is that not only the nearly 14,000 Minnesota Army and Air National Guardsmen, but the state and many of you have constituents that are reservists, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps reservists, Coast Guardsmen that reside in Minnesota, and are citizen soldiers that are restricted based on their Title 10 status. And so there are also recruiters, active duty recruiters, that have access to the same schools. They would be prohibited, I would believe, from their standard Title 10 status of not being armed by the Secretary of Defense. So that's a different issue. So you can see it's multiple jurisdictions and complications. And I don't want to belabor the answer to you, Representative O'Driscoll, but I think we owe you some thoughts on that. It would not impede our soldiers to not be carrying, because they're not now, but it goes back to the force protection. When they're in the public, are they a target? And if we have everybody in uniform, and we haven't made that decision to arm everybody in uniform, and I doubt if we will go to that extent unless a threat is such that would be, which would probably preclude going off the school systems at some point until the threat is mitigated. So I would like to give you a more thoughtful answer and some background on that and some pluses and minuses before we would launch into mandating to school districts what they can and can't do.
Representative O'Driscoll. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up, if I could, with General Nash. I wasn't specifically referencing recruiters or other military personnel on school grounds. I was just using that kind of as a parallel that we have had questions, concerns, and issues on that, and I've been able to find ways to resolve that. Could that still be done with the installations that your members would be and National Guard members at all would be involved with. And again, I want to underscore, I think our purpose in having this is, do you feel you have the resources? Is there something that this legislature could do to help you in the way of laws or resources to be able to help you more effectively protect our men and women who serve this country?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, as I said in my statement, there, we believe I have sufficient authorities to protect individual service members in the Minnesota National Guard that are in uniform, that work for us every day. My comments went to 80% of those that are out doing civilian jobs. It's very difficult because they're in civilian and have very little control to mandate what they can or can't do. But I believe, and the governor certainly has sufficient authorities, as the threat would be escalated, to do certain things, whether, as some states have done, through executive orders. But we believe, looking at the 18 federal and state statutes that apply for this subject we're talking about, weapons and arming service members, that sufficient legislation exists that can be used. And we would certainly come to this body and to discuss anything that would prohibit us from protecting our service members. We would not be bashful, Mr. Chair.
I've never known you to be bashful, General. So, any other questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, sorry, I'm kind of a guest of the committee, but if there was bills that come through, they would come through my committee as well as Representative Detmer. I'm a little depressed from the testimony because I was on Facebook this morning discussing this whole thing, and the entry that I made in Facebook was, I hate to be a pessimist, but I don't think that anything will be done. And from your testimony, I have the greatest respect for you. I was in the Guard for 13 and a half years and an officer also, and for your position. But I just got a feeling you said that you can do things, but whether you actually and the governor actually will, I'm hoping that it doesn't take somebody pulling up in front of the Mankato Armory, my hometown armory, where I did my service. I mean, these armories are just completely porous. There's no concrete barriers. There's no locked doors. There's no armed sentry. Everybody knows that. Mankato Armory, the state-of-the-art armory, had a burglary there all night long, and they took $1 million worth of guns, and they still haven't found the person that did it. And so I really worry that unless something happens, and I've heard talk about, well, we'll raise, like on the famous movie with DEFCON 1, 2, 3, 4, that there's a threat level, I imagine, that you can raise. But raising the threat level means, well, today you're twice as likely to be assaulted as you were yesterday, but they still don't give them any arms or anything. And so I'm hoping that it doesn't take an incident to maybe put one armed person at each armory, or a capability of somebody that can get into the desk and get to a firearm or something, because so far in these tragedies across the nation, the only thing that stopped the guy with a gun is another gun. And so I'm hoping that something is done, and it's good news to say that you've got all the power that you need to arm them, and I just hope that they do. So that's my two cents worth.
Thank you, Reverend Cornish.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I could address Representative Cornish.
General Nash.
Representative Cornish, again, thanks for that comment. I don't want to leave this information hearing with the impression that we're not going to do something. That's not the intent. We have spent considerable amount of time, and Colonel Batter, if I could have that, with the federal force protection levels that we have, that we operate on currently. We certainly always have the ability to escalate that unilaterally, not taking what U.S. Northern Command has proposed to us. And if you can read that, it's an eye chart. But anyway, this is a product which obviously is not to be included in the record. It's sensitive information, but this has been developed over the last 2 weeks with our planning cell that Colonel Batter has headed up with regards to force protection and personal security, broken in different categories and different levels. And what this has is the ability to go to, as I mentioned, shutting down of all armories and arming everyone at the far right-hand side of this. But you can't sustain that for a long period of time. Your resources and your manpower don't exist. And when you do that, the rest of the government the rest of the operations of the Department of Military Affairs basically stops. So you can only go that far for a certain amount of time. what I need to tell you is that we're looking very hard at this, and decisions will be made in a period of time. And I'm not driven by time. I'm driven by threat-based analysis and information that there'll probably be a mixture of military arms, because this is still a military organization that will deal with it with military-issued weapons, but also relaxing, taking a look at very seriously the concealed carry restrictions that went into effect by the Department of Military Affairs in 2005, which precludes concealed carry on individuals with a state permit while on state facilities or while in uniform. So those are being looked at, Representative Cornish, and so don't come away with the impression that General Nash is not doing anything. He's waiting for something to happen at Mankato. We certainly have those facilities like that at more risk around the state of Minnesota. When they were built, they were not built with the current threat after 9/11 with force protection, standoff distances, non-ballistic windows. All new facilities we're building have federal regulations and restrictions now we have to build by, and we're trying to retrofit those that we can, but we're stuck with 65 that were built. Most of them were built over 49 years ago. The majority of our facilities are over 49 years ago. So it's going to take time. It'll take resources if we're to continue on this path of reinforcing our state training and community centers versus armories. I mean, this is open to public, and we need to protect the public that uses them for a variety of reasons.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yeah. Go ahead.
General, just one thing I'd ask you to keep in mind, and you know this even more than I do, that if a pickup pulls up in front of an armory and two guys jump out with guns, a good cooperation with law enforcement isn't going to do you a darn bit of good. It's going to be over in 10 seconds. So, and a gun locked in a vault in the armory without any ammunition is going to do you good. Keep that in mind. That's why today I'm armed, because I don't like to turn over my self-defense to anybody but me. So.
Mr. Chair? Yeah. Representative Cornish, you're exactly right, and I believe what you'll see at some point in time, those concerns we've all discussed and addressed and have a solution for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Chair. Representative Cornish, one final thing is, in my earlier days, we had the arms room, and I'll pick Faribault Nowatonna for an instant. The weapons were in the arms room, and the bolts were in the locked up in the sheriff's department or in the local police department, and the ammunition was at Camp Ripley. Those days we don't have any longer.
That's good, and I think the committee should also realize that the governor, the commander-in-chief, had made a statement that the minister, he was asked if there was plans to upgrade the security of the Minnesota National Guard recruiting facilities, and the governor told reporters that he is sure that those policies will be reviewed, and he has said that the matter should be handled by the federal officials. Now, I'm mixed up with that. It should be handled by our National Guard. Am I correct, General?
Mr. Chair, those facilities are rented facilities. The storefronts are where we have service members. It's a storefront is basically a permanent location where we have recruiters that are open to the public and young men and women looking for a career. So they are leased through the state of Minnesota, through the Department of Military Affairs. And so they're privately owned. And they could be next to a laundromat, they could be next to a daycare center. You probably have seen them as you traveled around the state.
Sir, General, are we talking then that we're talking more of this issue regarding the security of our facilities as a federal issue? No, this is from the governor, and my understanding is that the National Guard is in charge of our National Guard facilities. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. We have federal dollars that support our facilities,
yeah.
But the facilities that we have at AHATS up in Ramsey County, which also has a Army Reserve Center on there, is a federal piece of property that is leased by licensed back to the Guard to use, but it's a federal installation, as is the 133rd Air Force or Airlift Wing Base, mm-hmm. and the Duluth Air Base are three federal installations that we have. And we're precluded from taking actions unilaterally, for instance, on AHATS because of the federal policy that the Secretary of Defense, as I mentioned, has control over, as well as the two air bases. And so we have a mixture of state-owned facilities, storefronts that are leased, and federal installations in Minnesota. So it's a complex issue that each one has to be looked at independently based upon DOD directives, regulations, policies, and laws, federal and state.
So, General, I guess I got a what-if question. As Representative Cornish pointed out, that could happen. What if something did happen at one of our recruiting stations or our armories? How fast does your command change their policy?
Well, that's a hypothetical question.
Yeah, I know.
That I tend not to answer.
Okay. But
we can, with credible threats given to us by law enforcement, the federal authorities, the FBI, we can ramp up security to the extent of closing facilities within hours in terms of protecting that facility, notification going out as a pending threat. So communications to our force across Minnesota is not an issue.
I have one more question. In terms of the permit to carry, as I mentioned before during Representative Heinzman talking about the possible legislation, is it possible to have that type of training with our National Guard during drill weekends or during annual training? That's certain, I'm not talking about everybody, but certain people that are maybe the full-timers that are there at those stations that could be certified. And is that possible, that the Guard could do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would ask this committee or representatives here, based upon what the state law talks about, qualifications for trainers to train concealed carry for the citizens of Minnesota, whatever that requirement is that of training they need to provide to train a trainer, if you will.
Right.
And so there's obviously within the state statute exists a trainer that's certified by the state of Minnesota to train concealed carry. I would counsel you against having us train our own folks for a variety of reasons. As I mentioned, we have insufficient time, and I think your sons would tell you that the mandated training time exceeds the available training time for our soldiers. And so on the list of priorities that I have to be able to work my way through for our federal mission, this would be another added time constraint, because it's more than 2 hours when you take the initial training to get certified by a licensed trainer. I believe it's an 8-hour course, and the recertification I think is less, but at least an 8-hour course and then range qualifications. I think if the committee were to look at something, they may want to look at reimbursing an individual on his own time or a reduced fee to obtain a concealed carry through the state of Minnesota's existing process, or waiving the fee that they have to also pay to the sheriff's department to review the background before they license a permit individual. So I think there's things you could do there to ease the financial aspect of individuals seeking a concealed carry. But I would ask that the committee not consider putting it into the military to train for a state permit. I think the process exists out there. I think there's assets that are out there in the commercial market for individuals to seek that if they so desire.
Okay. General, just to follow up on that question then, so let's say if something was passed in the legislature that we were able to look at those that are full-timers in the National Guard facilities to get them trained, would they be allowed then by the National Guard to carry while they're working, the full-timers? I'm just talking about the full-timers, not the general population of the Guard and Reserve.
Mr. Chair, if the decision, down the road, in time, makes us come to that decision to arm full-time members in a facility or multiples, we would certainly issue a military weapon that they have been trained on, that we would take responsibility for vetting them, for training them, and for arming them.
Okay.
And we would not ask them to do a concealed carry personal weapon because it could end up being a 22 Derringer up to a 357 Magnum with a variety of ammunition. And mm-hmm. we're, again, a military organization. If we're going to protect our facility and our uniformed members at their workplace, we'll take that responsibility on and we'll arm our soldiers to the threat required.
Okay. We have other questions from the committee. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Nash, I have been just reflecting on a number of the comments and questions that have been asked by members, specifically Representative O'Driscoll, who posed the question, if you have everything you need to make the decisions that you are, you know, potentially about to make relative to what we may need to do here in Minnesota. But then when Representative Cornish asked, made the comment actually about how porous some of the installations are, specifically Mankato, he referenced, and you know, you referenced the aging population or the aging, you know, buildings that we have and how many of them we have, and I can't help but think that there's a significant capital expenditure that we should be looking at and planning for relative to glass or technology or, you know, whatever that might look like. But I think there's a real sense of urgency for us to be considering as a body what that looks like so that we can be prepared to give you, in fact, what you need to make the decisions that I'm hopeful you'll make to ensure protection of our service members. So I'm wondering if an assessment has been done on what those costs are or how much time that might take to do so that we can be prepared to act in support of you.
Mr. Chair.
General Nash.
Representative Pugh. We've done some preliminary. We always have conditions of our facilities, and basically as we come back every year or every 2 years for capital expenditures for updating, modernizations, HVAC, energy efficiencies, we have that basis. We also have a rough magnitude of what it would take. Some are physically impossible, and I'll give you an example. Northfield Armory sits on Main Street on the corner, and it's sandwiched between a bank and another historic building. You can't do the X number of meter standoff or blast. I mean, it's just physically impossible. So some of those things are in the can't-do box. You know, rough magnitude, it's about $500,000 if we're going to put in key card access, panic buttons, other types of passive anti-terrorism measures. Initial study that was done in the last week was it's roughly about $500,000 just to do those things. But it doesn't include, and I don't want to leave you with the impression, the pickup driving up to the front door of a Northfield Armory, park it on Main Street, put money in the meter, and 20 feet away is the front door of the armory. We would have to move that armory to another safe site. Mm-hmm. All of our sites that we propose that will come for bonding in the future with federal money, state money, all have setbacks, and we're talking hundreds of meters. And so we're buying land that these are not community-centered anymore, downtown Ortonville and Wadena. Those were the old days, and now the force protection requirements are such that these are basically standalone facilities out in greenfields when we have to start them from scratch. So, but we'll owe you an answer back on that, Representative, in terms of the existing facilities. If we went to the force protection measures that we can do, what that cost would be for the legislature to consider.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Representative Fugue, any follow-up? Okay. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Major General Nash. You referred to language and talked about different aspects of how you arm, and certainly language is important. And there were a couple of things in your testimony that, as a citizen, I served in the Army a couple of years, not in the National Guard, and I was not in combat and was not trained on handguns. We used old M14s at the range. But I'm concerned a little bit when you said we're dependent upon our protection from the local law enforcement agencies and the DNR officers. And then you talked also about lone wolves, and you mentioned the theater in various places, and certainly that's been a topic of conversation for a number of years in terms of zones that are prohibited from having firearms on the premises. It bothers me that in those areas where we have seen lone wolves perpetrate violence, it always is in a place where they're gun-free. I would hate to see a member of the National Guard put in a position where that is also a gun-free zone, where, you know, at least we allow our citizens to have right to carry in areas that are not in those gun-free zones for self-protection. Now we're putting a National Guard person into an area that we've basically declared a gun-free zone. We're not permitting him to carry, and we're not providing protection from internal protection from within the force. I would think, to me, from a citizen standpoint, when we talk about our armed forces, not to arm them seems a little bit ridiculous. At the very least, I would think we would proceed with what's happening now and the threat danger coming and the targeted that we're at with our armed forces and National Guard, that we would take very seriously the concept of arming within the Corps and training within the Corps and providing protection if we're not going to allow our National Guardsmen, when they're in their public service, to arm themselves. That's more of a statement than a question, but I guess I'd like your reaction to that. It seems to me that the public is saying, hey, these are not ordinary times, and these are not ordinary situations, and we need to proceed cautiously, but we also need to proceed, and we need to make sure that the protections are there on the forces. The other thing, and I didn't quite understand it, you said we are prohibited, the military is prohibited from gathering intelligence information. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? I'm concerned a little bit about the safety factor of people joining the National Guard with intent of doing ill. what is our safeguards when it comes to our recruitment policies in terms of internal threats within our Guard?
General Nash?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me start with the last portion, Representative Hancock, first. We do, obviously, background checks on individuals, young men and women who intend or decide to enlist in the Minnesota Army or Air National Guard. So a background check is done. That's only as well. It's only as good as the information that we can gather from authorities when we seek information on someone at a young age, you know, 18 to 35 years old. The same, as you were making your statement, those same things have been going through our heads in our planning process in terms of we live in a different era now in terms of the public seeing us, well, you're a military and you don't arm yourself in a homeland. Well, that's been historically the case, and as I mentioned, in the Modern Guard, that has been the case. And as I also mentioned, the policy at the Department of Military Affairs, and I believe it came out probably some years back from state MMB or what existed before MMB in terms of policy of non weapons on state facilities, which would obviously include the armories. Those things are being looked at very hard that you just brought up, and those are the same discussions we've been having for the last several weeks in terms of the different dynamics that we currently have. Again, law enforcement plays a huge part in this, again, because we don't do law enforcement. in the Minnesota National Guard. We leave that up to the local, the sheriffs, the counties, the federal government. We rely upon them. And to your point about we don't gather intelligence, you're absolutely right. We don't gather intelligence. There's an intelligence oversight law, and we would be in violation of federal law and policy, and we can't collect on citizens in the United States. Those are by federal laws, and so the federal the FBI and other authorities collect intel. We are the recipients of information that's being analyzed, intel that's been analyzed, to inform us of possible threats to our facilities and people. So I need to make that very clear that to the committee and for the record that the Minnesota National Guard does not do intel work.
Follow-up?
Just on a follow-up to that very point, General, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some question as to the accuracy and the viability of some of our intelligence-gathering communities when it comes to identifying potential ISIS and other extremists. Do you feel that in recruiting process where you're gathering this information for the background checks that the speed in which you're gathering them and the accuracy and the are you content that you're receiving sound information?
General?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hancock, I believe we are. I have not heard any instances where information that has been provided for their background or for their security clearances is anything but expedient and accurate. Okay. But that concern, Mr. Hancock, obviously with obviously in the state of Minnesota, without getting into those details, we also have those same concerns about possible applicants to the Minnesota Guard or active service also.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I picked up, General Nash, on your presentation is that besides looking at security, we want to make sure that our personnel are safe whenever they're working for our military forces and in their workplace. And one of the things that struck me is you mentioned that there has been occasion workplace violence in the past, and you have a number of people that are reporting to you who've been in traumatic situations, and you were saying have got issues out there. And what I'm wondering is what more can we be doing along those lines? And the reason I'm asking that is because anecdotally, as I've looked at shootings at military installations across the U.S. Over the last few years, it seems about two-thirds of them have been actually done by military personnel themselves because they didn't get, it seems that in many instances they were suffering depression, etc. So that seems, in other words, I like to take a look at all-encompassing is besides taking from the exterior threat, what is being done, and are we doing enough internally to help make sure that we're providing the resources to make sure that we're keeping our people safe and making sure they're getting the treatment there that they need?
General Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, thanks for circling back on those earlier comments. The other things that keep me up at night are those same issues that we have individuals that have mental health issues, PTSD issues, and it's just we're a slice of that age group of individuals that we report. We're very transparent in Minnesota in terms of when an issue happens, there's always a tagline, member of the Minnesota National Guard, not that they're a member of XYZ company or they belong to this organization. They always tie it back to the National Guard for whatever reasons. But we do have those concerns about that we're dealing with. But we could be more effective in the area of mental health, and I think if you do the background look at whether it was in Fort Hood, whether it was at the Naval Yard, whether it was in Chattanooga, all these had a string back to a mental condition that was not found or indicated or reported, and they slipped through and this happened. You can take the theater she's going through sentencing now in the civilian world. In the last one, 2 weeks ago, I think there would be a tie to a mental case of being missed. And so there's always that there that we are always concerned about. Now, the last case in Chattanooga, there's been no discernible information that I've seen that made a direct link back to ISIL or Daesh or ISIL in terms of of instigating that. Now, there may come out that way, but this is probably another individual with mental health issues. I would also tell this committee that those instances that I just mentioned, both at Fort Hood, the Naval Yard a couple years ago, what happened in Chattanooga, have all been at an installation, on an installation, not targeting individuals walking into a Walmart with a uniform. And so that's also the basis of how we're approaching a decision that we're going to be making here in Minnesota. They were all on a base that had people that had weapons at the gates. And so that's concerning when they attack a facility. It goes back to Representative Pugh's comment about trucks outside and Representative Cornish's at Mankato. Those are also concerns that we have to deal with, other than concealed carry and arming soldiers outside of a military discipline organization. So, but we would certainly seek out your assistance, because we do have some barriers that exist in Minnesota through our TRICARE system. Individuals that we have in the military are of a certain, they could be a student with not much of an income, but their guard pay puts them over so they can access our county health care facilities. They're precluded. And so there's some things in there that ought to be looked at in terms of the accessibility. If they can't afford to go up to get treatment at a mental health county, or they're not eligible for veterans status at the VA hospital, we've got to be able to issue or deal with that issue internally in the state of Minnesota to provide that care for them. And that, and right now it's a challenge, and we work with human services on that, and our Yellow Ribbon partners around the state in our communities that we have. And some of them are doing some things pro bono for some assessments, and we have some own assets, so at least identify that in the state of Minnesota. But there's a group of people that, because of their income level, cannot afford to do that, because just being in the Guard can put them into another income level that they can't apply for that service. So I think I would ask you to take a hard look at that, and we can certainly come back and provide more data to you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Nash, yes, I'm very interested to have more data, more information. I feel very strong that mental health issues are not much different than somebody who's got diabetes or somebody who's got cancer, but the problem is we have such a stigma in our culture, and sometimes it seems worse in the military. And anything that recommendations or anything that we can do to help make it easier for people to come forward, the barriers that you just identified where they may make too much and not be able to get the assistance, to me is very disturbing, and I think it's something that we need to take just as seriously as the other threats that we have out there. So any additional information I would greatly appreciate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, the same thing applies to chemical dependency and alcohol abuse. And so that's the total wellness, the total of an individual that I'm responsible for. And that's force protection also that I'm responsible for. And that's why I say those are the things. And DUIs, I'm concerned about a soldier driving down the road behind the wheel, maybe intoxicated, and it's going to run into a family and kill him.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to reinforce what the last part of that conversation, and I want to thank my colleagues here who assisted Representative Hancock and myself in getting some funding up in Bemidji for mental health issues. These are, and just all you got to do is pay attention to what's going on. You see mental health right in the middle of all of it, including a lot of CD issues. A lot of folks self-medicate because of underlying mental health issues. So I don't want to go too far down that road, but I want to reinforce that, General. Thank you. I do have a thing, more of a comment than a question, but appreciate any feedback you want to give on it, General. I thought I heard you mention that you were talking about military issue weapons for the military, and I just want to say I fully support that aspect of your consideration, particularly given the ease with which individuals are able to get fully automatic weapons. Roofball down Chattanooga, he had a AR, if I remember right, and your military issue 45, you better be awful close to that bugger. You ain't going to get him. He's going to get you first. So we've got our challenges out there because of our Second Amendment. I support Second Amendment, but by golly, we got to figure out, and we'll circle back to the mental health How do we keep folks who shouldn't have these weapons from having weapons? And, I mean, we've got to look at this holistically. It can't just be that we're talking about National Guard and recruiters and they need to have weapons. That if we do that, we're you know, missing the forest for a couple of trees here. So thank you for that military issue statement.
And I think our military issue is a 9mm, not a 45. Am I correct?
I'm dating myself. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, you're correct, yeah. But you took a good stab at Representative Purcell. There was a 45 until about 1984.
Yeah, thank you. It was a 45 when I was in back during NOM times. Yes, sir.
Other questions that we have? We have some other people that are signed up for a testimony. Now, is Colonel Vatter is going to be speaking?
Colonel Vatter, unless he desires to, but we had not planned to, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
He was here as a support role to answer any questions that I wasn't able to or
okay.
to deflect.
Well, Colonel Vatter, I'll check you off. And we got Major Lindsey Olson. I'll check you off. Okay.
For the committee, and again, Mr. Chair, Major Olson's our legal advisor and has dug into the federal and state laws and has been advising all along and goes back to the language issues about shall, may, will. You know, we're dealing with that as we go to Representative Cornish's question about not doing anything. That's not what we're doing, is not doing anything, but we're going to go very deliberately, and the language has to mean something, because at the end of the day, when bad things happen, they'll all come back to General Nash, the Adjutant General, in terms of, well, you said this when something bad happened. So mm-hmm. we have to look at the liabilities issues and the tort issues and protecting our service members, not only from violence, but also from legal matters that may come up.
Yeah. And I have Mr. Kerr. He just had some dental work done, right? Okay.
He has it. Well,
we will excuse you, Mr. Kerr, this time. So, and then we have Mr. Jason Quick with the Minnesota State Director for Concerned Veterans of America. If you could come forward, and maybe, General, just stay there, and you might want to respond to some of the comments, too. Welcome, Mr. Quick, to the committee, and if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jason Quick. I serve as the Minnesota State Director for Concerned Veterans for America, and I sit in this chair today as a veteran of the United States Army. Okay. I have a short statement prepared, and I'd be happy to take any questions after that.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Again, Mr. Chair, thank you, and the members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here to be here for your hearing today. My comments will be very short in comparison, but I hope that they are concise and address the issue brought forth here today from the veteran standpoint and from the service member standpoint. I'm glad to see the leadership both here and in the Senate here in Minnesota has taken up this issue and is treating it with the concern that it deserves. I have a lot of friends that I've served with in combat. Like I mentioned, I was in the United States Army from 2004 to 2011, deployed to Iraq 2 times during that span. And friends of mine that I served with in combat that are now serving as recruiters, and many of our National Guard here in Minnesota have deployed as well. In my opinion, they should have the means to defend themselves against potential threats, not only overseas, but here at home. On one hand, it saddens me that service members cannot assume a certain level of safety here at home. But on the other hand, service members are not strangers to the risk assumed anytime they put on their uniform. And by the time a civilian goes through the transformation into a soldier, a sailor, a Marine, or an airman, they are well frequented with the tools of their chosen trade, including individual weapons. And as has been brought up here in the committee today already, National Guardsmen face a unique problem in being expected to serve on active duty in uniform without the same force protections offered at active duty installations. And we tell our service members to be vigilant but at some time, it may be difficult for them to be vigilant with the tools that they have at their disposal at any given time. If given the opportunity, and this is my experience and the veterans and service members that I've talked to, the service members would without a doubt choose to defend themselves and those around them. And I would challenge this committee to ask the guardsmen that you represent, whether they're serving in a recruiting capacity or in any other capacity, how they feel about this issue. Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Indiana have all chosen to face potential threats that their guardsmen may face head on and take the action of arming their National Guard. My hope is that Minnesota will follow in their footsteps. Now, clearly, as has been brought up here and discussed at length, there are training and legal and risk assessment requirements that must be met. And I want to say that as a former soldier and as a current permit holder in the state of Minnesota, the disconnect between the training that you receive in the military and the training that you receive to carry a weapon using a carry permit here in the state of Minnesota, there is a disconnect there, and that needs to be addressed. Going a little bit further on that, the training that one goes through to obtain a carry permit here in Minnesota is not so much focused on the operation of a specific weapon system or how to manipulate that weapon system, but more importantly, what legal ramifications face someone that carries a weapon or, worst case scenario, has to implement that weapon system. So again, there are training and legal and risk assessment requirements that must be met in order for any member of the National Guard to carry while on duty. But my fear is that if no actions are taken, a message is sent to potential threats that our service members are soft targets. I know that's a term that's been used here in the committee today, but I think a message like that emboldens our enemies, and it does absolutely nothing to prevent any future attacks. I want to thank the committee again for your time, for being here, addressing this issue, and for allowing me to speak on it. I can take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Quick. And do we have questions for Mr. Quick? General, do you have any comments regarding Mr. Quick's presentation?
No, Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate his testimony today and his point of view, and I think, again, as I mentioned to Representative Cornish, I don't want anybody to leave here with the impression that we're doing nothing. Regardless of what I do, I'll be criticized for it. I understand that. That just comes with the job. But we're trying to obviously have a balance between protecting our force and protecting our citizens and doing it in a rational, methodical way to reassure not only our service members but their families and those citizens in the state of Minnesota. So I think at the end of the day, Mr. Chair, you'll probably see a blending of actions that we will take to get to the end result of providing protection for our facilities and our members.
Thank you, General. And my research has come up with what other states are doing, and I can give you a copy of this. I know you're working for the National Guard Bureau. Yep. And
Mr. Chair, these are, you know, as of yesterday, those states that have taken action, those that have personal carry. I believe there's five states as of yesterday that the TAG or the Adjutant General or the Governor has done that, as well as arming forces. I think there's seven states that have armed their force. Six have signed an executive order to do something.
Okay.
And so there's a blend, but again, the majority of the states, I think, are going through this in a methodical, logical, thinking their way through this before they go to the point, because as I mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, once you do it, I would defy anyone to tell me what are the methods then that you're going to roll back to what we have today and how long will we be able to do that. And because there will always be a threat that someone can always do that. So it's going to be a long term. Once you've done this, when is that threat not there anymore? And I would submit to you that I can't envision that.
Yeah. Thank you, General Nash. And I think we all can agree that we certainly live in a different environment today compared to prior to 9/11. And you just look at all of our, you know, government buildings and so forth, the security that we built up around our government buildings and so forth. And I think I personally have confidence in the TAG and that things will be done that really need to be done. And I hope that we don't have to discuss things later with this committee of problems that have occurred or have occurred, and then now what do? We hope that the National Guard would take all the precautions that need to be taken to save, to protect our force at our facilities. And with that, I'd like to thank the General for coming forward and Mr. Quick for coming forward. And is there a Professor Joe Olson? And would you come forward and Professor, would you introduce yourself and for the record? Why don't you take the other chair?
Yeah, I'm a little too short for that chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Olson. I am a professor emeritus of law at Hamline University, which means I'm now retired. I'm also the chairman of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, the organization that was probably the primary proponent of the concealed carry reform laws that passed in 2003 and 2005. We fully support removing any policy obstructions that would prevent Guard members from carrying in appropriate circumstances. Most of that is matters that affect the state military itself, which the General has talked about. With regard to members of the Guard whose names, identities, addresses, and other personal information has been hacked, or who might be attacked off base, the concern is with our permit system. We have probably the best permit system in the country. It requires a 3-stage background check. It requires training, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And it requires that you be a competent person in terms of handling the firearm. Your military training will, of course, give you competence in handling a rifle. It may not give you competence in handling a handgun. But with regard to the permitting system, the most important thing, I think, is the protection that the training, particularly the legal aspects, gives to the person who gets a Minnesota permit and who doesn't go around it. Police officers are allowed to carry without a permit because they have an enormous amount of training on the legitimate use of deadly force. Minnesota has a 49-word statute. The rules of engagement that you get when you're a soldier in the military can run to as many as 3 pages. That is because a team of lawyers have analyzed all the possible situations that they think might come up. They've applied the law to them, and they have written out a bunch of specific instructions. You don't get that under Minnesota statutes. You get that in the training course. And we don't believe, the military doesn't provide that in basic training. They don't provide that in advanced individual training. Those are matters which the soldier needs to know on the street when he's defending himself. because he's not on base, he's not acting pursuant to orders, the state of Minnesota is not going to pay any liability he runs into. He's going to have to pay it himself, which means he's going to have the understanding that comes with the training that's provided with the licensing system. So I would encourage you to make the licensing system more available. Now, that's actually very easy. It will require some public relations. It doesn't require a change in the law. There's already a provision that allows sheriffs to issue permits very quickly to people who apply for them. Now, they have to have the appropriate training, and you might decide that you want to subsidize the cost of the training for members of the National Guard. But once they have the training, it requires a background check, which is done electronically through the MNCS system and through the federal NICS system, and takes about 2 minutes. The sheriff has some processing costs, which probably run under $30, and the legislature could decide that it would subsidize that cost for the member of the National Guard. So there's no reason why our sheriffs can't be taking applications tomorrow and issuing permits the same day to people who already have the training. People who don't have the training can take it next weekend. They can go in next Monday, and there is no reason why the sheriff can't issue the permit Monday afternoon. The law in Minnesota provides that kind of flexibility already. So we don't need a change in the law. We simply need a more effective application of it. So we support our soldiers being able to protect themselves now that their names, identities, and addresses have gotten out, and we don't know who has them. Not only when they're on base and there are armed security forces to protect them, but when they're in their homes, when they're on the street, and when they're going back and forth to their armories wearing their uniforms, which, of course, is like wearing a big target on your chest. I'm a veteran. I understand that. I understand the threat, and I understand why they would feel that there are a lot of situations in which their being members of the National Guard makes them at risk, but situations in which the National Guard as an organization can't protect them. That's why we have a permit system. That's why we have probably the best permit system in the country. And that is a permit system that can operate as quickly as from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9:30.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Olson.
You
any questions for Mr. Olson? I know. I don't know. Some of you that have served in the military, and I just purchased a new pickup truck, and I ordered my license is going to be a veteran's license. I also have a sticker on my truck that says retired Army. So, basically, what have I done? I'm a target. So, those are some things we need to consider. When we're in today's environment. Anyone from the public would like to address the committee at this time? Anybody from the public? Okay. I would, before I adjourn, in your packet you have some reimbursement forms to fill out. Would you please fill them out and have them turned in to Jeremiah before you leave today. So, but with that, General, I really appreciate you coming in, spending the time here, and we know that this is an issue. It's not just a Minnesota issue. It's a nationwide issue that we're talking about here with all the different states and all the different governors taking part in this. And I know that you and your staff will be on top of this, and if there's anything this committee can do, the legislature can do to support you in the decisions you make, please don't hesitate to come to us. We can always call another meeting. So Thank you very much, and this committee is adjourned.